I'm sure it occurred to some of you last week when you listened to the podcast. I'm sure some of you were wondering, just why does Kirsten have a bucket of honey in her car? And I'm not going to answer that question. It's a long story, but maybe because the entire bucket of honey spilled last week, I might have learned my lesson. I'm not sure yet, but I think carrying buckets of honey in my car is just not worth it. Not worth a cleanup at this point. Anyway, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I have some super exciting news. I have another Patreon subscriber. Thank you, Ethan Hope. You are a rock star. If any of you out there would like to support the podcast, help me put this beautiful content out into the world, please consider going to my Patreon page and become a supporter at either $3, $5, or $10 a month. Supporters and subscribers get all sorts of sweet little extras. If you do decide to become a supporter of the podcast, please know that you'll have my undying gratitude, and it means so very much. This week, I interview Mayor Tomasky. Mayor, like many humans, wears a lot of hats. Not only is she a functional medicine coach who engages in coaching people to be their healthier, better selves, but she's also an incredibly gifted massage therapist. I think when I met with her, she mentioned that she knows 28 different kinds of massage or something like that. She also has her own podcast. I was recently a guest. It's called The Human Restoration Project, and it was so fun. It engages with so many different topics. You really should check it out. I will have a link to the podcast on the treasures page of the website, but speaking with Mare was just a joy. We covered a lot of bases, and we got to talk about one of my favorite animals, opossums. I know they're not everybody's favorite animal, but I do so love them. So now, without further ado, episode 127 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
So one night, I'm a vocalist, I sing, and one night I came home, pulled into my driveway in the west suburbs of Boston, and there was this strange noise coming from this tree in my driveway. And I looked up, and there was a possum in the tree making the strangest noise. I don't know if anyone's ever heard a possum. I don't know if it was a mating call, if it was in distress. I didn't know anything about possums, and I stood there and just took this guy in. He was on a low branch. I just decided to start singing to this possum.
So my first question is, who are you as a human being? If you had to self-describe or go to a party or you're speaking at a conference or to a group of people, how do you self-describe? Who are you?
Well, I've thought about this question, Kirsten, because it's very deep and it could be looked at from a variety of angles. You know, who am I spiritually? Who am I emotionally? Who am I in my career? Who am I in my relationships? Who am I to the world? Who am I to my family? And there would be a different answer for each one of those. And perhaps to explain the way I hope I've developed myself would be, I am a seeker. I'm always looking for understanding, and I love to learn. So, you know, when I do my VIA Character Strengths survey, which is this values in action survey that we do as coaches for all of our clients, the first top strengths that come up for me are appreciation of beauty and excellence, love of learning, and justice or fairness. So I think I've tried to live my life so that I can be useful and bring something to people that they might not be getting elsewhere. And by that, I mean, as a body worker, craniosacral therapist, yoga teacher, someone who thinks a lot. I have thought deeply about human suffering and justice. I think those things are closest and nearest and dearest to my heart. And I didn't have the constitution to be able to continue being an activist and make the world a better place through my body, through my actions. So I honed it into my career. How can I make my career something that is brings something of value and positivity to the world? And it's on a micro level. And when I was a kid, I wanted it to be on a macro level. I wanted to do something big to change the world and make it a better place to live and create more fairness for people who had been marginalized. That's a big deal because I was marginalized as a child. So I saw the whole world through the lens of someone who didn't think things were fair. And in some ways they weren't. And in some ways, those things that were perhaps unfair shaped me into the person I am today. So I honor them now, that those, you know, things I bumped up against as a kid turn me into someone who's equal measure seeker, compassionate healer, and really angry pagan heathen woman who wishes she could do more to level the playing field. So there's equal measures of kindness, love, and agitation inside of me at all times, because I wish that the world could be different than it is. And yet, no matter how hard we work, it seems like there's always this disparity. And maybe that acceptance is something I'm now working on.
So interesting, the understandings that come over time, because I too was one of those people that wanted to do big things. And I just wanted to take a big bite out of all the injustice in the world and just solve it in one broad stroke. However, over the years, I've understood, you know, one person is not going to be able to do it all. And I love that old adage that, you know, you can take one stick and you can snap it. But when you put 50 sticks together in a bunch, you can't break that. And so I came to this understanding, oh, you know, I can be one of the sticks and I can join with others. And, you know, even if that other person is on the other side of the world, if we're doing things to create beauty in the world or create a better life or kindness, you know, those sticks all together, it'll be harder to break our backs. One of the things that I am so curious about, you know, I always have walked around assuming that everyone's like me. They want to make the world a better place, whether it's, you know, saving the whales or food insecurity or what have you. But I meet a lot of people in Santa Fe who do not give a crap about that. And they're just, you know, here to enjoy Santa Fe, be here, drink coffee, and kind of live mindlessly. And they don't feel called to lift others up. And so my question to you would be, do you think this innate feeling, because for me, it's an innate feeling of justice, how to bring justice into the world. Do you think it's something that you're born with or it's cultivated in the society around you?
Wow. I have a feeling that's such a thoughtful question, Kirsten. I have a feeling that it might be a smattering of both, because it may depend upon the environment with which you were sculpted as a child, may depend on what you got to watch and look at as a kid, what were your influences. For me, I was really a bit of a geeky kid. I love to dive into big tomes like The Lord of the Rings. You know, I would read that every single year, starting with the Silmarillion, by the way. reading the entire series all the way to the end. And it would take me about 3.5 months. And in that are all these allegories of good against evil. And that shaped my young mind in a tremendous way, because I was so drawn to the whys of those books. I was so drawn to the characters who exemplified even steadiness and kindness and patience, because I didn't have a lot of that, because I was living in a very sort of chaotic, confusing, world as a child. And those books made me feel as though there was order, there was beauty and hope, that even in the darkest of places, you know, goodness will emerge. And the smallest among us, even the most inconsequential person, can make a difference. Those were the principles that the Lord of the Rings raised me on. Because really, when I would be confused, it was almost like a Bible for me. And interestingly enough, the allegories in those books were drawn from the Old Testament and J.R. Tolkien's great spiritual connection to mysticism and Christianity, which was not my gig. But he told those stories in such a neutral way that even this kid who was not religious could understand the deeper story, the deeper meaning in it. And so, and I was really into watching stories of triumph, books, you know, always had my nose in a book. And I think that that had a huge influence upon how I wanted to be seen or how I wanted to develop as a human being, was what I was watching, because the people around me were just trying to survive. So I don't think I got it from them. Did I come in with it? Probably. I think I came in with a big smattering of it because I was super sensitive. So I think those of us who came in as sensitive souls do feel a little deeper the pain of others and do see the things going on around them and can connect dots pretty quickly. And we move towards people, places, and things that help us make sense of the things that are confusing and perhaps not, don't feel right. So I think it was both. And I think I came in with a bit of it. And I think I developed a lot of it because that was where my little mind was going.
I mean, I think for me, it was growing up overseas and in third world countries and just being a kid and seeing insane poverty, but seeing how human beings are resilient and still living and creating lives amidst the garbage and the filth and the poverty and extreme, extreme hunger. You know, as a kid, when you're confronted with that, it is, you don't know any different until, I mean, coming back to the States was a complete shock for me. Because everything was so shiny, and it was the 80s. Everything was so shiny, and Jordache jeans and Velveeta cheese slices and all of these things. Everything was so, I don't know. There was like this gloss on everything. And as a kid, it was so discombobulating to come from a place where you're confronted with the reality for so many humans across the planet. And then you come to this kind of sterile environment where everything's, you know, all that stuff's hidden yes. in these Midwestern suburban homes. Yeah. And I will never be able to thank my parents enough for giving me that childhood. It changed me in ways that are irrevocable and probably are still unfolding.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
But the Yeah. But I think it is really essential. And you and I have talked about this before. Part of that also was growing up in all these different countries with different religions, which of course has made me a panentheist. And I don't subscribe to any one religion. My childhood and my religion was just so different from so many people that I know. What was yours like? Like, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like?
Yes. So I was adopted into my mom is Irish Catholic and 100% Irish Catholic. My dad is Eastern European, my adopted dad, Polish. And they're also Catholic. And my grandmother on my mom's side was extremely religious, did her rosary most days, went to church more than once a week. Really lived her life, you know, that generation. Religion was more important to that generation than it was for me. And I was enrolled in CCD, you know, to become one of these good little Catholic girls. And I rebelled against it almost instantaneously. It didn't make a lot of sense to me. I was very young and didn't really like going to church. I thought it was boring. didn't think that I couldn't make sense of what they were saying. It was a lot of mumbling. And the church, the priest that was in this congregation for most of my young adult life, I just couldn't connect with him. And I didn't feel anything. And I think I troubled my parents greatly with my curiosity around other religious traditions or spiritual traditions. And my psyche immediately was very comfortable in the realms of mysticism, expanded states of consciousness, using the body as a vessel. And you know, Catholicism was really about divorcing your mind from your body and not having a connection to your body. There was a lot of shame, especially for young girls. And what did I do? I went to become a yoga teacher and a body worker.
I was going to ask, you know, sometimes when people go to church multiple times a week, they have a more mystical understanding or connection to that divine source. Do you feel that was the case with your grandmother?
Wow. I'd like to consider that, because that could certainly be true. I mean, she may have really been one of those Catholics, Christians. I don't know. I hope so. I know it gave her a lot of solace, but I had a feeling that what came from that was more about fear and following the rules than it was about discovery or self-discovery or going into their own lives and examining themselves as perhaps spiritual beings. It kind of looked more to me like religion than it did spirituality. But I bet there were private things for them that, of course, they wouldn't have told their granddaughter, because they probably wouldn't have thought that I would have understood the more mystical side. I don't know.
It's interesting. I have discovered that the people who are more drawn to the mystical kind of element or feeling in prescribed religions tend to be more generous and kind and thoughtful. I'm only saying that because I think to even approach that realm, that kind of the unknowable, the unnameable, you know, you have to have this kind of curvy approach to life is what I call it. Like you can't be all straight lines and corners. You have to be okay with spaces that might be a little scary or uncertain. And it doesn't mean you have to dive right in and go crazy or lose yourself, but you can kind of play at the edges of that for a while until you get comfortable. I can totally see how mysticism and those kind of elements can be scary for a lot of people because it's mystery out there. You know, it's scary. It's the unknown, which I think is like exciting. I always wanted to go out into the woods when I was a kid because I was sure there was adventure out there. Like I was going to meet something was going to happen. Like I was just going to have some experience that would be completely would blow my mind. I love the woods for that, because I think there's a lot going on in there that we don't really understand. But no, I will never get in a submarine and explore the mystery of the deep ocean. I will never, go to the International Space Station when that's available. I don't care about those places. But the woods, for sure. Yes. And I'm sure, you know, the desert has those mysteries too. You just have to live here and have experience with it or get in conversation with the desert to experience those. So to be honest, like most of the people I interview are, they're like, I started out as this, but I no longer believe. And it just is following, my interviews are following on point what all the studies are saying about religion in the US right now, and how people are leaving the Catholic Church, the Baptist Church, these churches that are so, I don't know, that have so many controversies, that are really have these super fraught histories with a lot of injustice and terror and, you know, in the Catholic Church, carnage. And they're looking for a space, I think, that is more generous and kind and compassionate, a community that, while it is comprised of humans, will probably fail daily, but that you feel safe in. So I think it's really interesting and fascinating to see what's going to emerge from this. Hopefully more generous and wise communities, less cults. We're going to hope for less cults.
Less cults and more direct connection with the divine without the mediation of a dude. I've read a lot of books about the mystical traditions of Christianity and psychedelics, because there is an intersection there if you go back far enough, which I'm finding extremely fascinating. And the bait and switch was, we'll take these pagan people who are using medicinal and psychotropic medicine in their sacrament, because they are having a divine experience that's them connected with spirit, not in a church, but out in a field, expanding their consciousness. And they were told that's what the sacrament was going to be. And they gave them that for about 300 years, apparently. And then they slowly started taking that away and gave them this book, these books instead, the Bible, the Quran. Like, you know, you just have to have faith now. You don't get to have the divine direct experience. No, you just have to have faith. And we are going to tell you how to behave because we know better than you what good behavior is. But you're just going to have to trust us, because you're no longer going to get that direct divine experience through the psychedelics. Now you're going to have to just read this book and have faith. And that worked for a while because there was consequence to not doing it that way. But now I think we are out of the box. There's no fear that the church can put into any of us anymore. The older generations that needed that form of religion, because they had different social situations than we did. You know, there was good reason to be organized into these churches with these strict dogmas and these ways to believe, to be and behave, because society and culture, the world was a very different place back then, and that served them. But it hasn't evolved very much, has it? It's too late. You can't put that cat back in the bag anymore. We're out. We are looking for more meaning and purpose and connection and direct experience than here's this book, read this book and trust me. Trust me that these stories are true. And now we're like, no, I want to feel in my own body, spirit moving through me. I want to feel connected to my breath. I want to feel connected to the cosmos. I want to feel connected to every blade of grass and every animal and every stick and every drop of water. We are going deeper than they ever thought that we could handle. And I think we can handle it. And quite frankly, I'm even of the mindset that if we don't do this, we're doomed.
Yeah, I agree. I always think of, I don't know, it's interesting meeting people who, trying to be diplomatic here, who are completely divorced from being in life. Mm-hmm. And their lives look like shopping every day or going to work. It's like they're skimming. It's like there's this stone skimming across a pond, where underneath them is all this magic and authenticity and maybe even a deeper, more real reality in the pond below them. Mm-hmm. But they're perfectly content to just live their lives without any kind of consideration for other people or deep thought about their purpose. And maybe that's their calling in this life. Maybe that's their calling in this life, and they don't really have to contribute. But I think a whole lot of people would be super excited if they kind of just broke the surface of the water and maybe, you know, put their feet in or something and experienced a little bit of that mystery, that kind of awe, all of that kind of magic that's out there that kind of wants to talk to us. You know, the early church, I think it's so interesting. And I'm talking about the Catholic Church now, you know. I do think a lot of it was about control. Like all of these kind of religious movements, I do believe most of them start off with really good intentions. But then you get membership, you get power. All of a sudden you need people to kind of run this whole thing. It becomes about money,
yep,
domination, and power. And that initial impulse to kind of create a better world or a better community, whatever brought all these people together, you know, conversation with God, 100% gets lost. Yeah. And the religions always lose their way. And I'm not sure, that must be intrinsic in humans, that when we get big enough groups of people who all believe the same thing, suddenly, I've talked about this before, it's like easier to hate other people that don't believe you, that don't, and it's easier to kill them. And it's like, oh, now, like, we have a big enough group of people who believe this one thing, we should just kill everybody else. I just don't understand why it's so easy to go to that point. It just seems like every living thing should be given the grace, that space to maybe change or evolve. I don't know, this is long and winding, but I was just thinking about how the early church kind of demonized so very readily, you know, man's connection with the natural world, with plants, with the trees, with the air. And in it, it suddenly became, no, you can only find truth here in this book. End of story. The book is it. Everything else out there is a lie, you know? And by the way, if you're talking to that plant or that tree, you've got a demon in you and you need to be killed.
Wow.
And it just seems such a simplistic thought process. Like, there's no depth there. I'm not saying that the early church fathers were idiots. That's not what I'm saying. But at times I feel like they cultivated idiocy in their flocks. And that's a harsh statement, but a lot of people weren't being their best selves for how long has it been? 2000 years, yeah. 2000 years of people not being their best selves and trying to find any excuse that they could to kill people who didn't believe in them or didn't believe what they believed in. I don't know. I try not to think about it because it's a little overwhelming.
A few things come to mind, and most of them have been between me and the animal kingdom, the magic that happens. I've always loved animals. I've always had a way with them, often would rather be with them than humans. So one night, I'm a vocalist, I sing, and one night I came home, pulled into my driveway in the west suburbs of Boston, and there was this strange noise coming from this tree in my driveway. And I looked up, and there was a possum in the tree, making the strangest noise. I don't know if anyone's ever heard a possum. I don't know if it was a mating call, if it was in distress. I didn't know anything about possums, and I stood there and just took this guy in. He was on a low branch. And my dear friend Robin was visiting me from Colorado because her home had burned down. And she was staying with me while she was looking for the next thing she was going to be doing. And she was in the house. I had just come home. And I just decided to start singing to this possum because I couldn't think of anything else to do. I couldn't tell if it was in distress. I just thought, I'm just going to sing. And I used to make up these songs with animals, and I started singing to him, and I just sang for a good 3 or 4 minutes, and he calmed down. He kind of laid on the branch, and I thought, okay, he seems better. He seems calmer. I go into the house, told Robin about this possum, and she was like, oh, well, that's so sweet. Wow, you calmed. It was like a lullaby, you know, and we're sitting on the floor in the living room doing yoga, and all of a sudden, I'm hearing this bizarre noise in my bedroom, and it sounded like someone was trying to get in the window. And I had an air conditioning unit in the window, and Robin and I were like, oh my God, someone's trying to break into the house. So I grabbed a knife. She grabbed the broom. We go into my bedroom. The shade was down, and all that was sticking out, of course, was the air conditioning, and we're hearing this scratching. So I pull up the shade with my knife in my hand, and she's behind me with her broom handle. And it was the possum. It was the possum. And I just burst into tears because he came down out of that tree and and got onto my air conditioner. Somehow he knew I was in there. I don't know. I don't know if he knew I was in there. I don't know. All I know is he wanted to be closer. So I lifted up the shade and I sang to him again. He was laying on my air conditioner. I sang to him again and he literally fell asleep on my air conditioner and slept there all night because I got up at 3:30 to pee and he was still asleep on my air conditioner. And that little possum changed my life forever because I've always wanted to talk to the animals. And when I'm realizing, you know, and I've done this many times, it works with ducks. Ducks really love to be sung to. They'll just fall over and fall asleep. And what I realized was my way of connecting with the animal kingdom is through my voice. And they really like to be sung to. And it's not even, it's oftentimes it's just vocalizing. There's sometimes I make up words. Sometimes I just vocalize. And I've done it with a variety of different creatures. And they all fall asleep. And to me, that's one of the most magical things that I feel capable of as a human being, to somehow connect on a frequency level, on a sound vibration level, on some level that defies the species difference and the language difference, that music transcends words. And we can connect with the animal kingdom, with our essence, with our frequency, with our vibration of love. That changed my life in a way that made me feel, and I'm not even sure I can put this into words. There was something that happened inside of me that day that was an amplification of magic and the unseen and the interspecies connection between humans and animals, because we've treated them so unkindly. We've dominated them. We've been cruel to them. We've wiped them out. We've wiped out their habitats. We've wiped out their food supply. We've destroyed their migration routes. We have made this world, this planet, hard for them to live in. And if I can offer that, if I can have that connection, it healed something in me. Because sometimes I have shame that I'm part of the human family, that we're so capable of such destruction. And that moment of connection, I think it healed a wound in me that I didn't even know I had.
I think acts like that, you know, earlier I was talking about each of us being a stick and then coming together and being stronger. I mean, yes, the world is so challenged. And yes, there's so much just ugliness and depravity in so many different places in so many different respects. But, you know, I like to think, I mean, I love science. You love science, right? And, you know, there's the Planck field, there's the Higgs field, all this stuff. Whatever it is, there's a field behind everything where these particles are popping in and out of existence all the time. And, you know, that act of kindness of singing to that possum and soothing it and bringing it beauty, you know, so much beauty that it fell asleep, because I'm sure it appreciated your voice, so much beauty that it fell asleep. I like to think like those moments, those really gorgeous occurrences, you know, they affect the field and they become this beautiful, resonant, almost like sparkling. I imagine it as like a ball of hope, you know, not a ball necessarily, maybe, I don't know, some sort of resonant kind of shimmering act of beauty, that in the field, there's already so much ugliness because of everything that we're doing to each other, to the natural world, to the air, to all the elements. But if each of us, I like to think of each of us, if we can create these kind of gorgeous and lasting acts of beauty, they will fall into the field and or emerge out of the field and hopefully combat the kind of, what I imagine is kind of gray, miasmic ugliness of what everyone else is doing to the planet, to the environment, to each other. And that's what I hold hope out for, is that those kind of those acts of beauty that we do, that we help kind of give birth to in the field, hopefully one day they can find each other and overwhelm all the other yuckiness that's in the field. I don't know. Did I just create a new religion?
Hey, sign me up.
I'll never forget, I was looking out of my front window one night in Portland, and across the street there was a big elementary school that was bordered by a big chain link fence. It must have been midnight, and I saw this sweet little possum walking down the street, and he's on the sidewalk, but he's walking against a chain link fence, and he had like five cats following him in a row. And I thought, I don't know if the possum is the leader. Nobody was attacking anyone. They were all just hanging out, going on a trip somewhere. I thought it was the sweetest, most hilarious thing I've ever seen. The other thing I used to do is, you know, my cats were inside outside, and I hadn't really gotten them trained to jump in and out of the window. So I would leave my back door open and leave a bowl of food in the kitchen for them to just eat during the night. So one night I wake up at 2 a.m. and I hear this sound, and it's not a cat eating, because a cat just puts its mouth in the bowl. I hear what sounds like a hand scooping up food, and then crunch, 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 and then down, and then another hand. And I was like, oh my, what is in my house? And I thought, I'm not going to freak out. I'm going to handle this. So I went in the hallway and I turned on a light cautiously. And there was the biggest, fattest possum I'd ever seen in my life. He'd clearly been coming into my kitchen and eating for I don't even know how long. He was so fat. The light blinded him temporarily. And he was like, something just changed. He's like, what's happening? What's happening? And I thought, I need to make sure I get him out the door and I don't freak him out. So I snapped my fingers a couple times, and he was like, oh, and he just waddled on out the door. But I thought, okay, I'm going to have to keep the door closed now, because clearly this guy's been treating this as an all-night buffet, and he's probably not supposed to be that overweight at this point. So yeah, those are my little sweet little possum stories.
Wonderful. Wow.
Yeah. They're such sweet creatures. Thank you. That is an amazing and precious story. It made my heart so happy. I can't even tell you, because song is so powerful. It is so powerful, and so many people take it for granted, you know, that it's only made, you know, you're not successful as a songwriter or singer unless you're making money, unless you're successful. And just the simple act of singing every day, you know, can change everything. It can change a possum's life, that's for sure. So thank you. Do you have any other stories you want to share? I would love to hear anything.
So Rhiannon, I'll start with her, because she was a Blue Point Himalayan who had a genetic birth defect that made her purr sound like a little creature from Star Wars. She had a collapsing larynx, and every time she would purr, she would hiccup. And it almost sounded like a tribble or like a, I don't even know what. She was the cutest little, and she was tiny. She was the runt. I always go for the runt. My dog is the runt. Love the runt. I was in massage school in the 90s, living in Santa Fe, and had a two-story house up on the north side of town off St. Francis. And I was downstairs studying for a big anatomy test. And I had the window open in my bedroom, and it didn't have a screen in it. Because back in those days, New Mexico didn't have a lot of bugs like it does now. And I'm studying away, and all of a sudden I get a distress call in my head. Help me. Help me. Said it twice. And I didn't even think. I ran upstairs and looked. The window was open, no screen. Looked down, and my male cat was sitting on my car, on the hood. And I knew that they had both jumped out the window. Second story, have no idea why they jumped out. Maybe one fell and the other followed. I don't know. But my girl wasn't there. Rhiannon wasn't there. So I went directly. It was the bizarrest thing. I walked down the stairs, took a right. Don't even know why I took a right. Have no idea. Went into my neighbor's garage. And there was my cat in an empty garage being cornered by a German Shepherd. And it was a split second. Literally, I walked directly over past the Shepherd, which probably wasn't smart because I don't know this dog. But I picked the cat up and walked out of the garage with her. And she was shaking. She was frightened out of her mind. I have no idea how she got in there. I have no idea how I knew where to go. And she would also be the one when I used to get really bad migraines. And when I got a migraine, she would sleep on my head and purr all night. And I think it was her way of, not only did she somehow know that something wasn't right in my head, but it was her way of trying to heal me. And she would just curl herself, and I would always have these one-sided headaches. They were ocular migraines. And she would always find, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and that cat would be curled up against my head on the side that I had the headache, purring. So she was one of those beings, you know, you have throughout your life, if you're an animal person, you have a variety of different beings come through your life to steward and care for. And she was the most extraordinary creature that I've ever met.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode, and with all our little stories about opossums, I hope that you, if you see an opossum standing in the middle of the road, slow down and avoid hitting this sweet little creature. You would once again have my undying gratitude, because opossums, at least for me, are the most enchanting and fluffy little creatures out there. I need to thank Mare for telling me her stories and once again reminding me that song and music can be great healers, great enchanters of other beings, including fluffy little white opossums. To check out a little bit more about this incredible human being, there will be a link to her website under the episode's show notes. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode: Justin Allen Arnold, Taiga Sound Productions, Frank Schroeder, Music L Files, Alexander Nakarada, and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to all sorts of groovy stuff, including Mare's podcast, art by incredible artists, many, many things that I hope lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Mare. Find beautiful ways of connecting with animals, with those we think will never be able to understand us. I really think that music and song are going to be what unites us, human or not. It just seems to be this area, this space where so much can be communicated, you don't even need words. But be like Mare and believe in the power of song.